I should say that this is kind of joint work with Bob Gucke and Rob Speckens. Also, we've been going somewhat into somewhat different directions and been doing things independently and in parallel, and I hope it will converge someday again. So what I'm going to explain is kind of what my point of view on these resources and resource theories. So what do I actually mean by that? So the kind of thing that I would like to set up a mathematical framework for are questions of the type, given something which one would think of as a resource. So I have one available, and I have a desired one. So for example, I don't know, some sort of wind or electricity, and I have a desired one, something like, I don't know, whatever else, quantum entanglement. And I would ask, and then I can ask the question, is it possible to obtain the desired one from the available one? And if so, with what efficiency, sort of, is this possible? So this is the kind of questions I would like to set up a mathematical framework for, in which one can ask these questions and also answer them. So what are resources? So the kind of thing which I have in mind are the resources or objects which can be converted into other resources via processes. For example, let me give a first kind of toy examples before getting to something a bit more serious. If I have some money, I can use that money to buy coffee. And so this is a process which converts one resource into another one. Now, if I have the coffee, and if I have some time, and a mathematician, I will get a theorem, hopefully. So these are kind of processes which convert resources into other ones. And as we can already see here, this plus symbol, we can also combine resources. So a bit more technical examples might be that when we have randomness, we can use randomness to create, in cryptography, to create a cryptographic key, a secure key. The better the randomness, the better the key. Or to get to something a bit having more to do with physics, if I have a cold system and if I have a heat bath, then I can put these two together and use something like a Carnot engine to lift a weight. So this would be another kind of process, turning two resources into another one. Work in this case. Okay, so now what is the mathematical framework? Let me start with the definition. Of what I mean by a resource theory, a theory of resources, and then I will explain it. So the definition is this, that a resource theory is an ordered commutative monoid. So what does this mean? That we should think of D as, so D is a set, and this is a set of resources. And so this set comes equipped with a couple of things, which are, so this binary operation plus, a distinguished element zero, and an ordering relation greater than or equal to. So the plus is a binary operation which stands for kind of this combination of resources. This is just the mathematical model, sort of the mathematical structure of this model's combination of resources. And what this means precisely will depend on the context in which you try to apply this. So this is a binary operation is assumed to be associative and commutative. And now there is this distinguished element of the set D, which is a kind of a trivial resource in the sense that if I combine it with any other one, I get that other one. So this is just the empty resource. And so now the most important part of the structure, in a way, is this ordering relation. And this we're supposed to think of, the resource A is greater than or equal to B if there is a process which turns A into B, as we saw in these previous examples. So I'm choosing the direction of the inequality sort of to go this way because now I can think of A as sort of being more valuable than B. Because if I have a if I can turn A into B, in case I want to, A is at least, having A is at least as good as having B, because if I have A, I can always produce B. So that's why the inequality goes this way. And this is, should satisfy the usual axioms for an ordering relation, namely reflexivity, every resource can be turned into itself. A transitivity, that if A can be turned into B and B can be turned into C, then also A can be turned into C. And this kind of anti-symmetry. So if A can be turned into B and B can be turned into A, then I assume that at least on this mathematical level that A is equal to B. So this means that the elements of this set D are actually not exactly the original resources, but they're sort of more something like equivalence classes of resources. So it may happen that I have two resources which are perfectly interconvertible, so I can convert A into B and B into A, then they may still kind of look different. But for all these purposes that I would like to talk about, for all purposes of convertibility, they are the same. And hence, they are represented by the same element of this set D, of this ordered commutative monoid D. Okay, and finally, we have a compatibility condition between the ordering and the binary operation, which is this: if A can be turned into B and A prime can be turned into B prime, then it should be possible to turn the combination A plus A prime of A and A prime into the combination of B and B prime. So by just applying kind of processes in parallel or processes independently. So this is the mathematical structure, and this may seem kind of innocuous, but it actually turns out to be very rich and can describe lots of different phenomena, and I will explain some of these phenomena in the following. But before doing that, let me give some examples, more examples of now resource theories. The first example would be the resource theory of chemistry. I'm going to denote these resource theories, so these ordered commutative monoids by sort of these boldface letters. So let this be the ordered commutative monoid in which the resources, or its elements, are collections of molecules. So this stands, for example, for two molecules of water and two molecules of oxygen. No, sorry, one molecule of oxygen. This is a collection of molecules. And I'm writing that collection A is greater than or equal to B. So this defines the ordering relation in the monoid if there's a chemical reaction, let's say under standard conditions, which turns A into B. And turns exactly A into exactly B. Or it could also be a combination of reactions. Yeah, may not. So, for example, this is H2O2. This is hydrogen peroxide, also known as bleach. Under standard conditions, this cannot go into water plus oxygen. So these are not ordered in this way. But now, if I have additionally this additional molecule available, which is manganese dioxide, I think, then suddenly this collection of molecules can turn into that collection of molecules. Now, if you compare these two things, you'll notice that everything that has changed is just that this additional manganese dioxide is on the left-hand side and also on the right-hand side. So this is what's called a catalyst, that you have to put it in addition to what you already have, but you also get it back out, so you haven't lost it. And this is an example of catalysis, which is a phenomenon which may occur in pretty much any resource theory, and some it does, and some it doesn't. But now, as one should expect from any mathematical model of kind of real-world phenomena, this kind of ordered commutative monoid now is a highly idealized version of actual chemistry. So, for example, strictly speaking, that this inequality doesn't hold, this is actually not true, and there is a reaction like this under standard conditions, but it's just extremely slow. It is so slow that one can buy bleach in the supermarket, and it doesn't spontaneously dissolve into water and oxygen. So it's kind of idealized, but still. To give another example, this is the resource theory of what I would call the resource theory of paints. So let paint be the ordered commutative monoid in which the resource is a collection of buckets, and each bucket contains paint of a certain color. And so this collection of buckets can obviously be joined. If I have two of them, I can just take the union of the collections of buckets. So this defines the binary operation plus in this resource theory. And the empty collection of buckets is the neutral element. And these can be now the paints. If I have a collection of buckets, I can sort of mix the different paints, the different colors that I have available. And so for example, if I have one like this cyan, magenta, and yellow or something, I can mix them to get black. This is subtractive color mixing. And then I would define a collection of buckets A to be greater than or equal to a collection of buckets B. If B can be obtained from A by mixing the paints and or discarding buckets. So this is, these are kind of an irreversible processes. And those of you who know about general probabilistic theories and quantum foundations, this is pretty much actually like having, considering a classical ensemble in your state space, having an ensemble of states in your convex state space. So now let me finish with the examples for the moment and get to kind of explain some phenomena of that can happen in resource theories and different types of resources one can have. So for example, a resource A, I will call it disposable if it's greater than or equal to the empty resource. So that means that there is a process, or the interpretation of this is that there is a process which turns A into nothing. And so many resources are actually not disposable, although in the mathematical examples of resource theories that I've been looking at, this usually the resources are disposable, but in practice and in the real world, I suppose we all know that many resources are not disposable, like these, for example. So these resources are undesirable in that sense, because getting rid of them is costly and we can't just do this, or even impossible, and so their production should be avoided. Another type of resource, which another kind of phenomenon which is captured by this mathematical structure would be, so I'm going to call a resource M a machine if, whenever I have an inequality like this, it implies an inequality like this. So what this kind of means is that if I have two units or two copies of the machine, I can only use one of them, or I can only consider one of them and do exactly the same things. So having one machine is as good as having two units of it. And remember that I'm not talking about how fast one can do things or whatever, but I'm just talking about what can be done in principle. And having two copies of the same machine usually doesn't help. And so that's why I've called this kind of resource, which has this property, that's why I'm calling it a machine, because it kind of puts this intuitive idea into a mathematical definition. Just to give an illustration of a machine, this is kind of the biggest excavator in the world, I think, and having two of these wouldn't let us do more than having just this one, so there's only been one that has been built. One can show now, if one has this condition, that this implies that also having just more than two also doesn't help, also doesn't let me do more than having just one unit of the machine. If I have k units of the machine, that's essentially equivalent to having only one. So to give kind of a trivial mathematical example of a machine, in any resource theory D, the neutral element zero is the machine. But it's kind of a boring example, I guess. Now, I can call a resource dollar a currency. This is another phenomenon which occurs in these mathematical structures. If for any other resource A, there exists a real number lambda such that I can sort of take n units of A, process it, or kind of one is kind of tempted to say sell it for k units of this dollar resource, and then in turn use these k units of the dollar resource to again sort of buy m units of A. And this is supposed to satisfy that as this n, so these conditions are kind of saying that if this n gets bigger and bigger, I can make the ratio of this m to this n here 10 to 1, and the ratio of this k to that n here 10 to lambda. So this is kind of saying that A is, in a certain asymptotic sense, equivalent to having lambda units of this dollar resource. So in this sense, the dollar resource is a currency. It can perfectly interconvert things. So a unit of A can be sold in exchange for roughly, at least asymptotically roughly, lambda dollars, which can then be used to buy not just, again, instances of A, but because this condition holds for all other resources, I can buy resources of any other kind, whatever I want. So this is a very strong assumption on the resource theory that a currency exists. You can multiply by integers, yes, by positive integers. So it's a commutative monoid. It's not a vector space, but one can actually turn it into a vector space. One can take kind of an enveloping vector space, and that's actually what one has to do in order to prove some of the theorems that I'm going to explain. So it's pretty much related, yes. Okay, and so the last kind of resource that I would like to define is a universal one. So a resource U is universal if, for every other resources A and B, there exists an integer n such that having n units of U, when I put these together with A, I can get B. So this is kind of saying that I can get whatever I want from, as long as I have enough of this universal resource, I can do anything else that I want. And can be used to turn any resource A into any other resource B. And this, in actual many examples of resource theories, this such universal resource does exist. Now, for example, in a paint, remember the collections of buckets with the paints? If we just take one bucket of each primary color, let's assume that we only have three primary colors, and we take one bucket of each, then this is a universal resource because I can produce any other one by just, and in any amount, by just taking sufficiently many copies of this, of these three buckets of primary colors and mixing them. So the existence of universal resources is kind of more like a technical assumption which I need to prove some of the theorems that I'm going to explain. Now let me get to kind of just to illustrate the richness of the kind of phenomena that can occur. Now, types of resource theories. So far I've been giving examples of different kinds of resources, but now there are also different kinds of resource theories. So, or different properties that they can have. For example, we can say that the resource theory D is catalysis free if whenever I can do something with the help of a catalyst C, which I put in, and also get back out, then I can as well do it without. Or I might say that I might call D non-interacting, in lack of a better term, I'm not sure. If I can produce B1, a combination of B1 and B2 from A, then I can actually decompose this A into two components, such that the first component gives me B1 and the second component gives me B2. So the idea, I've essentially already explained it, that every process which output a combination of two resources, so B1 and B2 here, can be decomposed into a parallel application plus of kind of two processes, each of which outputs then the corresponding constituent resource B1, respectively B2. Another property that a resource theory may have is this kind of complementarity. If A plus A prime, combining A and A prime, is equal to combining B and B prime, and A is sort of better than B, then it often happens that this implies that B prime is better than A prime, can be turned into A prime. Think of this as sort of in terms of the value of the resources. If the value on the left-hand side is the same as the value on the right-hand side, but A is more valuable than B, then the surplus value sort of has to be somewhere on the right-hand side, and I think of it as being in B prime. So this is a property that a resource theory may have or may not have, and then the kind of theorem that one can prove are relations between these properties or implications. So for example, if D is non-interacting, so it satisfies this condition, and complementary satisfies this condition, then it is catalysis free, then there is no catalysis possible. And the proof is relatively simple. So this is the kind of statement one can make in this formalism. Okay, now let me get to rates. So in many situations, we're not only interested in kind of producing one resource B from one resource A, but we're sort of interested in producing many units of B, given many units of A. And so if you look at this kind of situation, like mass production, then we know that this increases efficiency, meaning that if we ask this question, we might need less, as we take the number of units that we consider to infinity, the relative efficiency that we need may sort of decrease and tend to a certain limit. And this would be sort of the asymptotic efficiency or kind of the rate. How many units of B can I produce in this asymptotic limit as I take the number of units to infinity from one given unit of A? So this would be the rate, and a more precise definition actually requires an additional universal resource, and I guess I'm not going to explain this in detail now. This is just saying that in addition to having many copies of A, we also allow to use a small number of copies of this universal resource, as long as we take this asymptotic limit, this small number kind of in the ratio goes to zero. So that the ratio of this universal resource here, how many units I use of that one, to the number of units that I have of A can be made less than any epsilon. So this is the definition of rate. Then a number lambda is a rate if one can sort of get it at this fraction m over n of how many units of B I get given n units of A, sort of the relative efficiency of converting A into B. This is something which, this has nothing to do with reaction rates in chemistry, which are about how fast a reaction happens, but it actually is something which is widely studied in chemistry, namely in the subject of what's called stoichiometry. And it's not only studied in chemistry, but also for those of you who know some information theory, quantum information theory, I assume you will also certainly recognize this kind of definition. So now the proposition is that for any resource theory, okay, we assume this universal resource, that the set of all rates is actually an interval between a minimal rate and a maximal rate. And so depending on what kind of resource B is, so if it's kind of desirable or is it something which we try to avoid, we are trying to attain the minimal rate or the maximal rate. And now I would like to kind of get to the main theorem of which characterizes rates and which is at the moment kind of really, I think, the main theorem of this framework. So again, I need a little preparation. So namely this definition that evaluation is a function which assigns to every resource a real number. We're supposed to think of this as like an assignment of a value to a resource in such a way that, well, if we take the combination of two, then the values are just the sum of the individual ones. And also, if I can turn A into B, then A should really get assigned a higher number, a number at least as big as B. So also note that the value still can be negative. So some resources may have a negative value, and which is kind of the non-disposable ones at least. So the idea being that valuation measures sort of the value of resources in a consistent way. And in general, these are not going to be unique, but there are going to be lots of them. So there's not a unique way in general to assign a value or a price or something to a resource. But the fundamental theorem now characterizing rates is this, that if D has a universal resource and B in addition is disposable, then, okay, well, if B is disposable, then we can always throw away the copies of B that reproduce from A. So the minimal rate is certainly going to be zero. But the maximal rate turns out to be this kind of quotient. So those, if you know a bit of information theory, I suppose you will recognize this kind of fraction as well. So we sort of compare the value of A to the value of B, and this tells us how many units of B we can produce from units of A. And we need to sort of take the infimum or the minimum over all these possible valuations. Okay. Now, in many resource theories, we actually don't require the production or the desirable resources. We don't require for them that we can obtain them exactly, but often it's good enough that we have sort of an approximation to them and that we can make this approximation as good as we want. And so this is now something which, So examples of this would be the resource theory, for example, of communication channels, quantum communication channels, there are all this, there's this whole formalism of capacities of channels, how much information can I transmit if I have some noise and all that. So this is going to be a resource theory in which one allows this kind of approximation. Other ones would be then the resource theory of quantum entanglement, resource theory of thermodynamics. In all these examples, which are relevant for theoretical physics and especially kind of information sciences, I guess, one will have to allow this kind of approximation. So now the question is, how do we mathematically model this? This is something which the present definition of resource theory cannot do, because it doesn't say us what constitutes a good approximation to a given resource B. And it turns out that sort of the correct answer how to do this is that the mathematical structure that is already there needs to be augmented by or equipped with an additional structure, namely the structure of what's called a uniform space. And I'm not going to define what this is, but kind of a special case or a special subclass of this is that when you have a measure of distance on D, on the set of resources, when we can say how different two resources are, and this difference is measured by a real number. So meaning that I'm assuming that there is a metric on the space of resources. And so now the sort of still work in progress, so this is kind of tentative, but it works very well so far, but still there might be still be some slight changes to the axioms, that an epsilonification of resource theory is a metric on the set of resources, which satisfies a few additional conditions, some sort of compatibility conditions with this combination and the ordering. And, well, I'm not going to explain them in detail, but this is sort of saying that addition is continuous. That, well, this one might actually be interesting, that if A and A prime are delta close, meaning that their distance is smaller than delta, and I can turn A prime into B prime, and this B prime in turn is delta close to another B, then I can already find some other A hat such that I don't need to approximate B by a B prime, but I can actually produce this very same B from A hat, which is epsilon close to the original A. So I sort of need to do the approximation only on one side of the inequality sign. And I can also do it on the other side. And so this is what this says. And an additional technical condition, which if sort of the distance between two resources should kind of diverge in some sense as I take the number of units, the number of copies that I consider to infinity. Okay, so now as a mathematical theory, this is really kind of beautiful in the sense that it incorporates algebra, order theory, and analysis in a way which really produces such that they really fertilize each other in a sense. For example, one can show that the algebraic structure here is torsion-free, so which means that if I have elements A and B of D, and a number n such that n times a is equal to n times b, this can only happen if a was actually originally equal to b. So in principle, if I look at any kind of commutative monoid, there's nothing which guarantees this implication that it then follows that a is equal to b, and there are many counterexamples. But now because we have this analytic structure on the resource theory, this is an immediate consequence from axiom 3. So this analytic axiom has a consequence for the algebraic structure. And this is kind of, I don't know, to me, suggesting that this is a good way to do these things. Okay, and it seems that most concepts and theorems, for example, the rate theorem that I wrote down, have analogs in this epsilonified case when we consider these approximations. But this is still a kind of work in progress. And so, for example, remember this definition of the valuation function, which assigns a real number to each resource. The analog here would now be the same definition, except that in addition to that, it also should be kind of uniformly continuous. Okay, so let me illustrate this with an example, namely the resource theory of randomness, which is again kind of relevant to information theory. And so a resource in here, it's essentially, think of it as a probability distribution on a finite set. But so this I can consider is just to have a finite sequence of probabilities, and I assume them to be ordered in this way that I just can order them in any way that I like, but I'm just taking them to be ordered such that the biggest one comes first. And so they're normalized to total probability one. And equivalently, we could define this as an isomorphism class of finite probability spaces, if you know what that means. And now we can combine these by taking product distributions. This is the definition then of the plus operation. And well, the product distribution just has n times n many outcomes then, and the individual probabilities are just going to be the products of the original ones. And one has to be a bit careful because now these might not be in decreasing order, but that's a technical detail, so it's suitably reordered. And the trivial resource, the neutral element of the addition, is the deterministic distribution, which is a sequence of length 1, and has p1 equal to 1. So now the most important part here in the resource theory of randomness is this, that we put that p is at least as good as q, or alternatively we can obtain q from p if there is a coarse graining of P. No, sorry, if Q is a coarse graining of P, that means that there's kind of a deterministic way to get from P to Q in the sense of a function of the sample space of P to the sample space of Q, which produces us Q from P. Meaning that, well, if we have P available, and so I can kind of sample from the distribution P, then, and if I get a certain number, I can just apply this function. And if I look at the distribution of the images or the values that I get under that function, the distribution of these is just going to be Q. So for example, if I have a dice which has 6 different outcomes and probability 1/6 for each, I can simulate a coin by just declaring 1, 2, 3 to be heads and 4, 5, 6 to be tails. And this just generalizes that to arbitrary distributions that can obtain one from the other if there's kind of a deterministic function taking one to the other. So randomness is the resource. And now the distance between two distributions I'm going to find to be infinite. This is kind of actually not really made up, but this is I'm kind of forced to make these definitions because these definitions are precisely the ones which are commonly used in information theory. So a distance to be infinite if the sample space sizes are different, because then I can't really compare them. Or this kind of, it's called variational distance, or it also tells you how much weight I have to move sort of between the outcomes in order to obtain Q from P. So with these definitions of the different structures, I can show that this turns Rand into a resource theory, so into this ordered commutative monoid. And the metric also satisfies this big list of axioms that I showed. So this is an epsilonified resource theory. And, well, as I already kind of mentioned, it's fundamental, I think, in information theory. I think for things like compression of data, so Shannon's source coding theorem, but also things called randomness extractors. So now what about the valuations here? I'm trying to get to sort of an application of this rate theorem that I mentioned. So we need to look at what are the valuations in this resource theory. How do I assign a number to a probability distribution? And so a very natural thing to look at, I suppose, is this, it's called a partition function. This is pretty much like a partition function in statistical mechanics, right, where I have probabilities within the Gibbs distribution, e to the minus beta h. And this is exactly what I have here, except that so that I kind of take this e to the minus h to be my probability pk. So these are like the probabilities at temperature one, so to speak, and then I change the temperature by varying this parameter beta. And this way I got a partition function, which is a function of this real number beta. And from there I can get what's called a Rennie entropy of the distribution, which is kind of a simple, essentially just a logarithm of this partition function. And the main difference here is that I would like to consider this as a function of p for a fixed beta, in contrast to the partition function where it was kind of opposite. So this is a quantity which kind of an invariant of the probability distribution, which says how much randomness it contains. And the statement, this really turns out to be a valuation in the sense that I defined. In particular, if we take this parameter beta to be equal to 1, we get the Shannon entropy. And this valuation now is continuous, though, if and only if, and now this may be the surprise for people who know information theory, if beta is strictly greater than 1. In particular, Shannon entropy is not a continuous valuation here. And what this implies, something about the rates. The rate to go from a distribution P to a distribution Q is less than or equal to, now this doesn't actually use the rate theorem, but this is a simple consequence of the definition of valuation, the minimum of all these ratios. And this may also be a bit surprising if you think that the only invariant, or sort of that we know how much randomness there is in a distribution as soon as we know its Shannon entropy. And so if we have two distributions which have the same Shannon entropy, then it might be or should be sort of asymptotically interconvertible with rate one. But this is not the case, and all these Rennie entropies sort of give you conditions under saying when this conversion is possible. And the conjecture actually is that this holds with equality, but this is still a kind of work in progress. And so this would give a kind of operational meaning for Rennie entropy, which seems to be kind of, usually a Rennie entropy seems to be considered a bit mysterious in information theory and having unclear operational meaning. But this would be one possible operational meaning then, that it kind of gives us an expression for the rates to convert one distribution into another one. Okay, so that's essentially all that I wanted to say, and thanks for the people that I've been discussing with, and which are also great resources.
So, as usual, we like to give students the first chance for questions. So, are there any student questions?
Hi. So, as a graduate student, I would say that one of my most valuable resources and the one that's probably in shortest supply for me is time.
Right.
How do you handle time as a resource in that, you know, you can't really convert anything else into time, and yet you need time to make just about anything else? And some things might be a lot more beneficial if you did have enough time to do them, and yet we simply don't.
That's a very interesting question. So let's say that, so initially one might be tempted to say something like, I'm going to assign to every process which converts A into B the time that it takes for this process to happen. So this would then be a label, sort of a real number T for each process. But alternatively, one can also describe this in terms of, think of you have this kind of like a bank account, but not with money, but with time, saying that you have a certain amount of time available. And so now, instead of writing the old A and B as resources, I'm going to write A comma T naught, which is like a real number stating the account balance kind of on your time account. And now, given that we have this process which takes time T, we can say that define kind of a new resource theory, still with resource theory meaning in the old, in the definition that I explained, where this is now defined to be greater than or equal to B, and now I have to take into account that I consume time, so I have to subtract T from this account sort of time. So in this way, I get a new resource theory which implements this thing that time processes take time. And the time is kind of just an additional, one can keep track of time by keeping it at this kind of additional side information. Did that answer your question? I don't know what else I could say.
I think, as we all know, it's also quite possible then to take some amount of time into a smaller amount of time.
Right, yes, okay, good point. Yeah. So we should also say that this is greater than or equal to A and any T naught prime, where T naught prime is less than T naught.
Any other student questions?
Hey. By definition, resource theory, the objects are not necessarily invertible. Of course, there are some examples you can think about where you could have a resource that is invertible. Maybe like a
Did you say invertible?
Bill. Invertible in the sense that they combine to the neutral element.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh. Right. So are there examples of resource theories that instead of being a monoid, they'd be a group? And if not, when you...
Yes.
Yes. And you talked about when you have to prove some of these theorems, there's this enveloping vector space.
Yes.
Which contains the inverses of all the objects that aren't necessarily invertible in the monoid. So could you just comment on invertibility in general?
Yes. So actually, there is a totally general construction which, to any given resource theory D, assigns one in which all resources are invertible. And so invertibility would mean, or we can think of it as something like, for every resource A, I also have one available, which is, I also have minus A available. So instead of having A available to me, I can also be in debt for A. So having minus A would mean I need to pay it back. And So one can associate to any resource theory in which no objects may be invertible, another one in which all of them are invertible. So this would be, I'm not sure, let me just draw this tilde now to indicate this. And in this new ordering, so this is a new resource theory in which everything is invertible, so which means that one can go into depth for any resource. And what this describes, if we take now A and B in the previous D, then they are comparable, or we can convert them with respect to this new ordering if and only if there exists a C such that A plus C can go to B plus C in the old previous ordering. So this new ordering is sort of the one which describes conversion up to catalysis. And so this is what this new thing captures, is the kind of what we then call the catalytic ordering. Because here we can always go into, when we have this possibility of going into depth for any resource, we can sort of borrow our catalyst C, we can then do the process, and then we pay C back. So in this example, there are many invertible resources. And when going to the vector space, there's a similar procedure now going from here to kind of an enveloping vector space even. And what this describes then is kind of going into this asymptotic limit of many copies.
You mentioned epsilonification in the context of approximating states, and perhaps you can't convert rho into sigma, but you can convert rho into a sigma tilde that resembles sigma. You mentioned also that the resource theories are idealized. You gave the example of chemistry. To a good approximation, there is some ordering, as in some chemical reaction can't happen, but in fact it happens very slowly. Is there a way that you can similarly incorporate the existence of this very small inability for this transition to happen into your ordering, a sort of a...
So probabilities one can incorporate, yes. So concerning the slowness of this chemical reaction, I wouldn't know how to do at the moment. But probabilities of having a process to happen, that one can simply incorporate by doing something very similar to this trick here. So if we have, for a process from A to B, if we have only a certain probability that it is successful, so a probability P, we can define a resource theory in which the objects, the resources, are pairs, again, a little bit like here, but now pairs of A, P, where P is something like the probability of having A, the probability of successfully having A. And then I can say, well, something like, no, sorry, I should call it P naught. That such a process, if I have A with probability P naught, and I apply this process, which is successful with probability P, well, what I'm going to get is B with probability P times P naught. So now this is a new resource theory which has absorbed these probabilities kind of into its definition.
So maybe let's throw the floor open to questions from everybody now, including students, of course. Any other questions? Okay. No, I'll go ahead.
Do you think that you could give an example of how someone might make a decision using this mathematical framework?
Pardon?
Could you give me an example of someone actually making a decision using this mathematical framework with like numbers in it? Like, I'm not a scientist, and I'm just trying to understand.
Yes,
better.
Decision for?
Just anything. Like, say I'm a policymaker, I have a scarce
yes.
number of resources.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thanks. I was actually expecting that question. But at the moment, I'm afraid I don't have a good answer because there's still a bit, I guess, in too early a stage to say whether one could give a reasonable answer to that and how that might look like. So what I'm trying to do at the moment is still develop kind of the mathematical framework, improve the theorems, and then apply it to kind of examples which themselves are mathematically rigorous things like information theory. And then, as kind of the third stage, see how it would apply to other more realistic or real-world situations. So that's all I can say at the moment.
Other questions? Okay, in that case, let's thank Tobias. Oh, sorry, there was one.
Can you start quantifying sustainability or talk about it mathematically somewhat? Because you're talking about resources, so probably.
Yes. No, so at the moment, this is also not, I can't, at the moment, also not something I can say anything about, sorry. So, yeah, it's just that I can sort of define, I can give definitions like this disposable, like this disposability, and other similar ones. For example, I can also say when a resource cannot be converted into anything else anymore, it's kind of a terminal one. But that's all I can do at the moment.
So, other questions?
But there may be a long-term goal too.
In The Capital, Karl Marx developed a theory of value.
Uh-huh.
And it was asking the question, what is value, what is the fundamental origin of value, why do we attribute a certain value to a certain product? It is not money, it is not gold. It found that at the end it was hours of labor, basically time.
Uh-huh.
He talks about crystallized time,
mm-hmm,
something
mm-hmm,
like that. So again, here you discuss two ways of implementing time in this picture. Could it even be considered a value? You have these valuation functions, right? Could it be something related to that, or?
That's what I thought. That's what I also thought for some time. But I think this is kind of more a more elegant way of incorporating time. Because a valuation function. Yeah, no, I'm not sure, but I think the better way to do it would be to say that time itself is a resource, and therefore an object in the resource theory itself, which can be then used or converted into other ones.
For example,
this is one way to do it.
Yeah, if you consider it as a resource, you could turn dynamical chemistry into stoichiometry,
right.
Basically.
Yes, actually, chemistry, yes. Research, yes, right? Yes, yes, yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't know about the connection to Marx, but thanks.
So I'm interested in these valuations. So it seems that there always exists the trivial valuation, where everything is valued to zero.
Yes.
Is there a theorem that always exists some non-trivial valuation? And
yes.
Is it generally the case that there are infinitely many valuations?
Infinitely many, that I don't know. But it's not always the case. There are infinitely many, but at the moment I don't have a criterion for when. So the set of all valuations forms is closed under taking positive linear combinations.
Okay.
So the set of valuations forms kind of a convex cone.
All right. And can't prove there always exists at least one non-trivial valuation?
Yes. Okay. So in this case, so without epsilonification, this is essentially a consequence of the Hahn-Banach theorem.
Okay.
So one kind of goes to this enveloping vector space, and in there one can apply functional analysis, which has a lot of techniques for finding kind of linear functionals on your vector space.
Right. Okay.
Any more questions? Okay. Let's thank Tobias again.